A police shooting in a small North Texas town over the weekend. Now a 22-year-old police officer charged with the murder of Jonathan Price. That story today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. We'll have more on the killing of Jonathan Price in an incident that has put the town of Wolf City in the spotlight amid calls for racial justice. Another sort of Supreme Court battle, this one happening at the polls in Texas. It wasn't so much the wind, but the rain. Remember Harvey? A researcher now sounding the alarm over hurricanes that stall as a possible new normal. And the case of the missing students during a pandemic. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on the 6th day of October 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Hope your Tuesday's going well. Anyone who's spent a little bit of time on the two lanes and back roads of Texas has driven through a place like Wolf City. It's about an hour northeast of Dallas on land that Dan Rather might describe as flat as a fritter. The parking spaces along the town's old main street are often as empty as most of the storefronts, where the occasional colorful awnings only hint at the small, bustling little Texas town it once was. A lonely old water tower still stands guard over the local feed mill. There are just 3 full-time police officers assigned to the town of almost 1,600 mostly white residents. But on this Tuesday, Wolf City, Texas is no longer just a sleepy little Texas town.
No peace! No peace!
Residents took to the streets of Wolf City last night demanding justice in the police shooting of Jonathan Price. Reports say Price, a 31-year-old black resident well-known and well-respected in town, was trying to break up a domestic dispute between a man and a woman at a local gas station convenience store. Witnesses say the man tried to stop Price from intervening, and when officers arrived, Price was first tased and then shot by a white police officer. He was pronounced dead at a nearby hospital. Shortly after last night's vigil, it was announced that the officer, 22-year-old Sean Lucas, had been charged with Price's murder and held on $1 million bond. Mark Haslett has been covering this story for Public Radio's KETR in Commerce. Mark, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. Good morning.
What are the Rangers saying about why this police officer, Sean Lucas, is being charged with murder?
The language from the statement that they released last night wasn't very clear. The exact quote is, "The preliminary investigation indicates that the actions of Officer Lucas were not objectionably reasonable." I think they meant objectively reasonable. In other words, there was no immediate threat to the safety of Lucas or anyone else present, and no reason to use his weapon. It's not clear whether Lucas was attempting to detain Price or he just wanted to talk to him.
What about details of how this all unfolded? Have local police, Hunt County officials, or the Texas Rangers given any sense of whether it was possible Price was in some way armed or posed some kind of threat to the officer?
Price was definitely not armed, and both the Texas Rangers statement and witness accounts say that Price was not posing a threat when he was shot.
Well, tell us a little bit about Jonathan Price and how the Wolf City community has been responding since his death.
We know that Jonathan Price was liked and loved in the community. He was from Wolf City. He went away to attend some college, but he came back home. He worked in the Municipal Public Works Department and also had a personal training business. Last night, about 700 people attended a vigil in honor of the life of Jonathan Price. I was there. I spoke with a young man from nearby Commerce who, along with some others, is putting together a clothing design business called Young Successful Kings. Price had been helping them get started.
I like the turnout to see how many people love them, to see just the environment. It's peaceful, no negativity here at the protest. I mean, in the end, it makes you feel good to know that he was loved.
Of course, you attended this vigil last night before the announcement that the police officer, Sean Lucas, had been arrested. Do I have that chronology correct?
That's right. The vigil ended about 8 o'clock, and we got word of the arrest and charge shortly before 11.
Any word on how the community's been responding to these murder charges this police officer now faces?
The community has been unanimous in its support for Price's family. I haven't heard or read anyone supporting the actions of the officer.
This police shooting comes as there's a period of reckoning in this country over systemic racism and police brutality aimed at people of color. Is there any way of knowing whether or not that has been a factor in the rapid turnaround of this case? That is to say, the Texas Rangers often investigate police shootings in small Texas towns. But is it striking to you at all that this murder charge now comes just a couple of days, not a couple of months or even longer after the incident?
The timing of the arrest and charge suggests that the evidence was compelling and the Rangers saw no reason to delay the arrest. However, it's certainly possible that the general climate in the country this year, combined with the local pressure from the Wolf City community, Price's family, and others, it's possible that that all played a part in the timing of this arrest and charge.
Mark Hazlett is with our sister station KETR at Texas A&M University Commerce, and he's been reporting on the death of a local black man, Jonathan Price, shot and killed by a police officer in the North Texas town of Wolf City. That officer now faces murder charges. Mark, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us. We appreciate your reporting.
Thank you, David.
A tremendous amount of attention is now on the U.S. Supreme Court and the confirmation process for Amy Coney Barrett. But Texas voters will be able to make important judicial choices of their own this fall, specifically who will sit on the Texas Supreme Court. KERA's Brett Jaspers reports on what's at stake.
The job is pretty powerful. The Texas Supreme Court is the highest state court for all civil cases.
There's been a whole bunch that they've been doing lately with respect to emergency proceedings related to the pandemic, related to this upcoming election.
Charles Rocky Rhodes teaches law at South Texas College of Law in Houston.
They're the ones who decide the rules with respect to divorces and family laws, looking at what the family code means, looking at the Texas Constitution, how it impacts family law, looking at the common law, how it impacts family law. So they impact a lot of our daily lives.
LGBTQ rights, voting rights, workers' rights. Here's an example. In 2018, the city of Austin passed a law requiring companies to let workers accrue paid sick time. A lower court struck down the mandate. When the Texas Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal, it didn't explain its decision that effectively killed Austin's law, but still left some legal questions unanswered about city sick time laws. Mimi Marziani is president of the Texas Civil Rights Project, which advocates for workers' rights.
That's the type of thing that can go up to the Texas Supreme Court, and I expect will at some point, and would affect the ability of hundreds of thousands of Texans, particularly working Texans, to have access to sick leave.
So these justices are important, and they're elected. But if you want to know how these candidates will rule in specific cases, too bad. Judicial ethics rules prevent them from saying so. The campaigns ultimately revolve around party affiliation and a more general judicial approach. For the past two decades, all Texas Supreme Court members have been Republicans. Current Justice Jeffrey Boyd says your party affiliation shouldn't affect how you rule.
Ideally, if you elect good judges, it's not going to matter what their own political or policy views are, because judges are trained and required under our system to set those views aside.
Boyd has been on the court for almost 8 years and is up for re-election this year. His view of the job is that judges should have a limited role, directly apply the law as written, and avoid using a law's supposed purpose as a guide in interpreting it. He says this approach is why he dissents more than any other justice. And Boyd says the court may have a reputation as being very pro-business, but the laws come from the legislature.
The laws of the state over the last 20 years have been increasingly pro-business, tort reform, medical malpractice reform, insurance reform. We didn't pass those laws, but it's our job to apply them.
Justice Boyd's challenger this year is Dallas County District Court Judge Stacey Williams, a Democrat. Part of her pitch looks ahead to next year's redistricting process, when lawmakers redraw federal and state legislative boundaries.
There are going to be lawsuits, but it's going to go up to the Texas Supreme Court. Do you want that decision to be reached by one Supreme Court full of one party? I don't think so, because it's not representative. Right now, the Texas Supreme Court does not reflect the state of Texas.
If elected, Williams would be the first African-American female justice in state history. There are races for three other slots on the court on this fall's ballot. And while Charles Rocky Rhodes of South Texas College of Law says there are some very good justices on the court right now, it would benefit from different backgrounds and perspectives.
Not every case that's decided by the judges can always be decided by just looking at a law book, and here's the answer. A lot of times the Texas Supreme Court has to decide the most difficult questions.
Questions, he says, where legitimate arguments can be made either way. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Tuesday, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. We're hearing from folks about that story at the top of the show, how the small town of Wolf City, about 70 miles northeast of Dallas, has been rocked by a police killing. As we heard, Jonathan Price, a black man, was shot and killed by a white officer, Sean Lucas, who's been arrested for murder. Lots of reactions coming in on social media. On the Texas Standard Facebook page, Bart McKay writes, "As a Wolf City native, I've been following since Saturday night, when a friend posted a live stream from the scene. He says it's a heartbreaking, needless situation and a good man gone. I'm praying fervently for Jonathan's friends and family, for the town's civic and church leaders, and for those charged with pursuing justice." And Lynn Watson Guy says it reads like another overreaction by a police officer who shot first before asking for information. This happens too frequently and must be addressed legislatively. Almost sounds like a call there to remove qualified immunity for police officers. Just one story that has folks talking today, David. Another one that has folks buzzing, to put it mildly. President Trump's return to the White House from Walter Reed Hospital, despite a positive coronavirus diagnosis. And the videos and statements he's released since then, statements like, "Don't let coronavirus dominate you." Quite a conversation unfolding about the president's remarks on social media, and I'll be back with reactions to that and other stories later in the broadcast.
And you know, the news keeps on coming. Ken Paxton, of course, facing criminal allegations from inside the Attorney General's office. A very interesting report from Emma Platoff with the Texas Tribune on an agency at war with itself. What's on your news radar, Texas? Reach out to us at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, and he's looking for you. He'll be back with more listener comments from across the Lone Star State in about 35 minutes or so.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at TexasOncology.com.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. Just 28 days till the election, and today is the start of a Texas-sized media ad blitz by Joe Biden's presidential campaign. Although neither the candidate himself nor his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, has made a stop in the Lone Star State, the Dallas Morning News reports the campaign reserved $5.8 million for ads to run in Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, and Austin. The Trump campaign, meanwhile, has been running targeted digital ads across Texas, spending a total of $5.9 million since March. Polls are showing a tightening race in Texas, with its crucial 38 electoral votes up for grabs.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at TexasMutual.com/on the job.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Something big could happen in Texas politics this election. For the first time in almost 20 years, Democrats have a real shot at regaining control of the Texas House of Representatives. Republicans have had complete control of state government in Texas since the early 2000s, but things have started to change recently. KUT Austin's looking into what it could mean if Democrats win a House majority in Texas. In a series called The Big Flip, As KUT Austin's Ashley Lopez reports, Texas's changing political landscape came into much sharper focus in 2018 during the U.S. Senate campaign of a certain Beto O'Rourke.
Let's start at election night. I was actually in El Paso with the O'Rourke campaign, and Mose Bushell was in Austin with the Republicans. Hey, Mose.
Hey, Ashley. How you doing?
So what was that like?
Well, I was with Greg Abbott and the Republicans downtown Austin. I got some sound from it here. I'll play you a little bit of the background music.
Fun little time capsule.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, generally, it was pretty upbeat. And I don't know, can I just stop that? So, I've covered a fair amount of GOP election night parties, and in Texas, they're often pretty upbeat kind of affairs, right? The Republicans usually do pretty well, at least outside of Travis County. So, yeah, we had some Prince playing, and people kind of starting to get loose. There's this bar downtown. But then I noticed after a little while that the whole kind of mood shifted. And at first, I wasn't even sure what was going on. You know, you're kind of scrambling around, trying to get tape, do interviews, call back to the station. But more and more people seem to be not talking, like not drinking, but looking at their cell phones instead. The way I remember it almost, it's like even the music kind of dropped. I know definitely that all the chatter of the crowd went down. People are standing there staring at their phones. And I remember asking this guy, what are you looking at? And he said that they were looking at these returns from suburban areas. I think I want to say it was like outside of Dallas. And that Beto was beating Ted Cruz in these districts that had been really like Republican strongholds, you know, for the last, you know, for recent history, I guess you could say. As you can imagine, you know, these people are starting to think, well, wait a second. If Cruz can lose these districts, he might lose this whole thing.
Yeah. And then, like, I remember the kind of inverse situation happening in El Paso. I remember when early voting first came in, that's when numbers started looking really bad for Ted Cruz, was very early on in the night. But yeah, we know how this ends, right? Ted Cruz won. Beto O'Rourke conceded. Yeah. Did the mood at least shift, like, at that point?
The interesting thing about, you know, my memory of that night now is that it did end up, you know, kind of going the way that initially people expected it to. Cruz won. The Republicans maintained a lock on statewide offices in Texas. But that moment still stuck out in my mind, right? That whatever it was, that 20 minutes or however long it was, when there was this kind of fear that I, at least as a reporter, had never really seen the GOP... I'd never really seen expressed at a Republican election night party up until that point.
Yeah. And I got to say, there's good reason for that to be a scary time for Republicans because, yes, Beto O'Rourke lost. But that same night, Democrats flipped 2 congressional seats and 12, a whopping 12 seats in the Texas House. I wonder if that's something that, like, Republicans even... like kind of reflected on. Did that seem to scare them, or was it all about the Beto O'Rourke race?
I caught up with James Dickey. He was the head of the Republican Party of Texas at that time. He no longer is. And he basically said that he thought there wasn't a lot of cause for concern for the party.
That was with all of the stars aligning about as perfectly as possible for his opposition. And so I hope that the folks who from all over the country put money into Texas trying to buy that election, I hope that they take that lesson to heart, that in the most perfect of scenarios, they still lost by high single digits. That is a significant rebuttal.
So anyway, that was my night.
Okay, well, thanks, Mose. Okay, so even though Beto O'Rourke lost that night, because Democrats were so excited and engaged by this very expensive, very highly watched campaign, they were able to flip these 12 House seats. And that was a very unexpectedly good night for Democrats. And Republicans have long said that it was only because of Beto O'Rourke's run, only because there was so much flowing in to that race, that Democrats even came out and they were able to win those seats, and they will not be able to do it again. They call this the Beto effect. Now, I've heard a lot of experts, particularly in the Democratic Party, say this is just flat out wrong.
Beto was a good candidate. He ran a great race.
That's Andrew Reagan with the Texas House Democratic Campaign Committee.
But we saw up and down the ballot, candidates performed better than they had historically, and that there was a lot of voter enthusiasm on the Democratic side. That's something that both in polling and in demographics in these districts has not abated.
When he said these districts, he's talking about these nine districts in the Texas House that O'Rourke won in 2018 that didn't flip to Democrats. That is, O'Rourke won them, but like the Democrats who was running for that House seat did not win. Now Democrats say they're really gunning for those seats because they're betting this is about more than Beto O'Rourke.
It's hard to really get your finger on the rapid change that's happening in these districts because it's both younger, more diverse, and it's more college educated than the country as a whole. And we've seen that college educated voters specifically have been repelled by both Trump and the Republican Party.
Republicans like Luke Macias don't see it this way. In fact, he says he actually thinks those districts are getting more conservative. Basically, there's nothing to see here.
Republicans are going to hold on to the House because Texans do not want to move our state in the direction of the socialist policies that the Democrat Party has established as their platform moving forward.
Pollsters, by the way, aren't calling this either way. Jim Henson with the Texas Politics Project is super plugged in, and he says he doesn't have any idea whether Democrats are going to pull this off.
I think it's closer than it's been in a long time, you know, at least 10 to 15 years.
Henson says Democrats in Texas just have more momentum, more money. And yes, their voters are just more enthusiastic. Henson says Republicans also have this other thing hovering over them coming into the election. That's the pandemic and the financial crisis that is happening right along with it in Texas.
In the period of Republican hegemony in Texas, Republicans have never really faced any kind of fundamental policy challenge that they had to address or solve. They've had, frankly, a long honeymoon, and that honeymoon is now over. And they're having to do torture the marriage metaphor, but now they're getting to the, you know, the hard work part, and they don't really have much of a model for it.
That story from KUT Austin's Ashley Lopez. The series The Big Flip continues tomorrow with a look at what a Democratic majority in the Texas House could mean for the state's economy.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A Central Texas congressman and former aide to Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is calling on his former boss to resign amid accusations of criminal activity. KUT's Nathan Bernier explains.
Chip Roy used to work as First Assistant Attorney General under Ken Paxton. That was before Roy ran for Congress as a Republican. Now, Roy is stuck in a close race for that seat against Democrat Wendy Davis. In a statement, Roy says allegations of bribery, abuse of office, and other charges levied against Paxton by at least seven senior leaders in the Attorney General's office are more than troubling. Roy says Paxton deserves his days in court, but says he should step down so the AG's office can function fully.
In a statement Monday, Attorney General Paxton called the allegations false and said he will not be resigning. Texans can still respond to the 2020 census, which will help determine how much federal funding the state gets over the next 10 years and how many seats it'll have in the U.S. House. The Trump administration had planned to cut short the national headcount on September 30th, but a federal judge has ordered it to continue until the end of October. A federal appeals court will decide by tomorrow whether to uphold the lower court ruling. In the meantime, groups across Texas are urging residents to take the short survey if they haven't already. Katie Martin Lightfoot is the Census Community Engagement Coordinator at the think tank Every Texan. She explains the state's self-response rate has been lagging.
Only 62.4% of households in the state of Texas have self-responded. That is less than the number of households that responded in 2010. So we really want to continue pushing that message out with the urgency, just because, again, we don't know when counting is officially going to end for the 2020 census.
People can take the survey at my2020census.gov. Tarrant County is the latest local government in Texas to officially recognize the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day. The proclamation this morning designates a time each year when the nation traditionally celebrates Columbus Day, which is a federal holiday. Tarrant County Commissioner Roy Brooks says the U.S. has a duty to address its historical mistreatment of Native Americans.
These things occur in small steps that grow bigger over time. First, we start with recognition that their contribution existed and was crucial to the history of this nation.
Last month, Fort Worth, which is in Tarrant County, and Houston joined the growing list of communities recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, over 5 million Texas children have daily access to nutritious school meals, many including local products. Learn more at farmfreshfriday.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texans affected by Hurricane Harvey need no reminder that it was the rain, not the wind, that did so much damage up and down the coast. The massive storm stalled out over southeast Texas, dropping as much as 60 inches of rain in some places. Although they weren't as destructive, recent storms like Hurricane Sally and Tropical Storm Beta have also stalled over Texas. And thanks to climate change, these slow-moving storms may now be the rule, not the exception. So writes Kimberly Wood. She's Assistant Professor of Meteorology at Mississippi State University. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Generally speaking, when did meteorologists begin to see Gulf hurricanes slowing down, and how much slower are they nowadays?
It's hard to quantify exactly how much slower they're moving, but we are seeing a disturbing trend in the increase of slow-moving storms in higher latitudes, which includes the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, it's interesting because I was talking with a colleague who said that he had noticed that these storms seem to be a lot wetter than they used to be. Is that just a perception, sort of a lingering after effect of Harvey, that, you know, in terms of perception? Or is it true that, in fact, these storms seem to be dumping a whole lot more water these days?
Well, as the atmosphere warms, it's possible for more water vapor to be in the atmosphere. And when these storms move through the Gulf and are connected to what we call deep tropical moisture to their south, as they move slower, they are bringing more rain to the same place because they're bringing in more water to create that rain. So as storms start moving slower and they have access to more moisture, we will be seeing greater and greater rain totals from these systems.
What are the forces behind this slowdown?
Evidence is showing that the steering flow of storms is slowing down. So if you imagine a storm like a leaf on a stream, it's the winds around the storm that are moving it as if it were, say, a leaf on a stream. And when that flow slows down, the storm will as well.
Are we talking about atmospheric flows like the jet stream, for example?
Yeah, like the jet stream or high pressure or low pressure.
And that is affected by temperature?
Yes. So the flow in our atmosphere responds to differences in temperature, and it's something called a temperature gradient when temperature changes across a distance. And if that gradient gets weaker, winds don't move as quickly because the stronger the gradient is, the faster the winds move. You can imagine it like you're sitting out on a lawn and you're next to, you know, a basketball court. You notice air moving because the basketball court is warmer than the lawn you're sitting on.
Mm-hmm.
But if everything's getting warmer, then the difference between those two places is a little bit smaller, and so the winds will move just a little bit slower.
I see what you're saying. It's the differential that's making the difference there. Does this phenomenon have a relationship to the increasing numbers of tropical storms reported forming in the Gulf, or is this a separate phenomenon?
This is a separate phenomenon, so the number of storms is not directly related, but if there are more storms, then we have an increased chance that they will be slow-moving storms, kind of like what we've seen so far in 2020.
I see. So putting two and two together here, how should communities, people living along the Gulf Coast of Texas, use this information to prepare for what seems to be a rapidly approaching new normal?
My recommendation is to always be paying close attention when the National Hurricane Center has a forecast that brings a storm into the Gulf, and pay attention to their key messages regarding what types of impacts could be present from a given storm. But to have a general plan in place for flooding that can arise from lots and lots of rain, know where you can go. If you are able to go to another location, know what you need to do to get there. If you can't go to another location, know where in your house or on your property you can go if water were to rise.
Complacency based on past experience, no longer really an option for folks living along Texas's Gulf Coast. Kimberly Wood is an assistant professor of meteorology at Mississippi State University, and we'll have a link to her article on why hurricanes stall at texasstandard.org. Professor Wood, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, complacency no longer an option, and right on cue, yet another hurricane has formed in the Gulf of Mexico. Hurricane Delta is the 25th named storm of the Atlantic hurricane season. It's expected to hit the edge of Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula sometime on Wednesday and reach the U.S. by this weekend. Current projections suggest the storm's most likely course will be the Gulf Coast just east of Texas, but that could change over the coming days. Delta is currently a Category 3, which indicates winds over 110 miles per hour. Meteorologists predict it could near Category 4 by the time it makes landfall near Cancun. Keep it here for updates. Texas Standard continues. It is approaching 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
This is the Texas Standard, and my name is Kimberly Harmer, and I live in Weatherford, Texas. I am a wife and mother of 7 children. I stay at home and take care of our household while my husband works, and he's a physician, so he's always had to wear a mask. So when all this started, he requested us as a family to wear a mask immediately. Very early on, I got online and I started looking up patterns because in my mind, I thought if I have to wear a mask, I want it to be comfortable. I want it to be individualized because I felt like if we could individualize it, it would be a more positive experience. My mother, when I was in junior high, made me take home economics. And in my junior high in Austin, I actually grew up in Austin. It was not the popular thing to do. I was so embarrassed to be in home ec, but I have thanked her for so many years now because it's been almost 35 years probably that I have been sewing. So when COVID started, my first thing was, okay, I'm going to the material store. I'm going to pick fabrics that I like, that I won't mind wearing. And I have settled on, for me personally and the most of my family, what looked like the masks that you see doctors wear that have gathers on the side and or that tie around the head or go behind the ears. I've made alterations. My one daughter likes it a little longer on the bottom so she has more room. My one son likes it less on the bottom. So what I did was I have a pattern for each person in our family of the way they like it. They each have customized exactly how tight they like it, and that's helped them be happier wearing their masks now that they've gone back to school, because in Weatherford you had the option to go back in person or do it virtually, and all my kids chose to go back in person, so they do wear masks a solid 8 hours a day. So it's really important to me to make sure that it was something that was personal and that it was comfortable. So if I had to total it up, I would have to probably guess I've made probably 60 to 70 masks. So I always thought, once this is all over, because it will come to an end, I've kept all my scraps for my material, and I kind of decided that any material that I had left, or a mask when we were done with all this, that I would make a COVID quilt. And I'm not a quilter, but I am a sewer, And so I've been saving all my scrap material to make some sort of blanket to commemorate this pandemic in a positive way that we made through it. And this is what we did. And each of my kids have fabric that they like specifically, and some don't like the others. So as I go through those scraps, it's kind of fun to think, oh, this was a really popular one. In fact, the one that I run out of completely of the material that I purchased is of puffins. It's a light blue with puffins on it. Boys, girls, you name it, they love it, which is so odd to me. And then other material that I've got, I purchased for myself and no one else likes it. So I have a lot of extra, so that's what I plan on doing with old masks as well as any scraps that I have. My name's Kimberly Harmer. I live in Weatherford, Texas, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
We're collecting stories from Texans about their masks. What do you plan to do with yours after we're no longer required to wear them? Help us keep track of this moment in history by sharing your experiences. Look for us on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Harris County's 4.7 million residents are weathering the pandemic, the recession, and recent disasters. And at the helm during this unprecedented time is Lena Hidalgo. She's the first female county judge, and her story is part of a special series we've been sharing during Hispanic Heritage Month. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval takes a closer look at how Lena Hidalgo got to where she is today.
In her 2 short years as Harris County judge, Lena Hidalgo has received a lion's share of criticism. And it's only piled on more during the pandemic, which has killed almost 2,000 people in the county. Here's Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick on Fox News in April.
And everywhere you see this draconian rules of locking down people and keeping businesses shut and destroying our country, it's mostly Democrat governors, Democrat county judges, Democrat mayors.
The governor's office blasted Hidalgo's early mask mandate that imposed penalties and her restrictions on business. We asked the judge about all that when we talked on Zoom.
It's challenging to see politics creep its way into disaster response. Folks were just calling saying, hey, I'm confused. What am I supposed to do? You're saying one thing, but I'm hearing a different thing from the state and a different thing from the federal government. So that fight's not over and the need for unity is not over.
She copes by going for long runs and listening to her favorite songs, like this one by Chilean rapper Ana Tijoux. COVID-19 is far from Hidalgo's first experience with chaos and tragedy. She was born during a bloody drug war in Bogota, Colombia.
You couldn't go to the grocery store by yourself because you had to leave somebody in the car so that the authorities could make sure it wasn't a car bomb.
To escape the violence, her family moved to Peru and later Mexico. There, she watched giants in Latin American politics fall from power. It showed her how government officials should not behave. Then, when she was a teenager, she made what she calls her most shocking move to Katy, Texas.
I had seen diversity, of course, but not like this. So that was beautiful. That was beautiful, beautiful. And then... Another noticeable difference was the quality of the public school system.
Hidalgo went on to study political science at Stanford. There, she learned why some institutions, like public schools, were successful while others failed. She thought about ways she could hold the government accountable.
Finally, after the 2016 election, I think a light bulb went off in my head and many other women's heads. And we said, well, hey, this is a good idea. If, you know, Donald Trump ran and won, maybe, surely, I'm qualified if he is. Vengo con mis ideas como escudo, con el
sentir humano, vivir este mundo donde el hombre nuevo. At 27 years old, Hidalgo defeated a popular Republican incumbent to become the first ever female county judge and the first Latina. And she says that election was the first time her parents had ever voted. Michelle Leal says Hidalgo's win is proof that other Latinas can do it too. She's a consultant, former candidate for the Texas Ledge, and works with the Latino Texas PAC.
The young women that I mentor, mostly college students, I often hear them lament that they don't feel like their vote or their voice matters. It makes me so happy for them to see someone who shares similar experiences and challenges as Latinas, as immigrants, as women in a position of power who didn't take a traditional path to get there.
Hidalgo says a favorite part of her job is seeing other outsiders get involved in politics.
Then I hope that for people who are interested in politics, whether they look like me, have my background or not, that at least it tells them, hey, you don't have to be of a particular background to run and to go and work for your community. Go get it.
Hidalgo plans to run for re-election in 2020. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trobal.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raisedyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. School funding in Texas is tied to student attendance. Many public school districts in the state have seen sharp declines in student enrollment this fall because of COVID-19. That's raised concerns these districts could start losing money soon if the usual calculations for state funding are used. A loss of funds could be devastating for public school districts' bottom lines. When might cuts kick in? We're getting a better sense of that from Aaliyah Swaby, who's been covering attendance and the impact on schools for the Texas Tribune. Aaliyah, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Which schools have you been reporting on that have seen the greatest decrease in enrollment?
So I think on average, some of the biggest urban and suburban districts have been seeing around, 5% decreases in enrollment. I talked to the superintendent of Alief ISD outside of Houston, and they saw a 7.5% decrease in enrollment, which is about a little more than 3,000 students, about 3,400 students. And a lot of those have been in pre-K and in kindergarten. I think the concerning part is that, some of these districts can't find their students. It's not just that students left for, private schools or left for charters, which is definitely true for some of them, but some of them just, for whatever reason, are unable to actually participate in their education.
They've just fallen off the radar for a lot of these schools.
Right.
Any reasons or explanations as to why is it that if families don't feel like they have the resources to get kids to school, or they can't take care of their kids and go to work, or what are you hearing in terms of possible explanations here?
Kids move where their parents move. Kids move where their caretakers move if they don't live with their parents. I think for some kids, it's definitely that they're being, shuttled around with if their parents have to go to work, maybe they're with a grandparent or maybe they're with, a family friend or someone who, does not have the ability to help them out with their homework. It could be that they have moved out of state because their caretakers actually, have family who are in a different state who can support them if they've been evicted or if they're having economic difficulties. And so I think that that's a lot of the reasons that districts are going door to door and knocking on the doors of where they think their kids might live, but they might not live there anymore.
As distressing as this is, Texas public school districts have a real incentive to keep those attendance numbers as high as possible, right? I mean, the Texas Education Agency had originally said it would fund public schools for up to 12 weeks this school year. Where do we stand with issues of attendance and school funding?
So the state education officials announced last week that they would extend that reprieve 6 weeks. So now for a lot of school districts, it'll be the first half of the year. They won't be penalized for dips in enrollment. There are a lot of school superintendents who are already asking for that to be extended to the end of the year. I think that pre-K and kindergarten are key areas of decline for a lot of districts because parents don't feel comfortable sending their very young kids, who some of whom are attending school for the first time in their lives to school at a time where, they might have to be behind a
plexiglass shield or, you know, the traditional aspects, the socialization of young kids in schools is a lot harder to do now. And so those things are pretty unlikely to entirely reverse themselves.
Once that relief period that the Texas Education Agency has announced expires, what then? I mean, you mentioned that some administrators are pushing to have this cover the entire year, but as we all know, departments' budgets have been slashed as a result of a loss of revenue.
The state has promised to look into this again before January, so we might see another extension coming. It's unclear as of now. I think if it doesn't happen, there are some districts that have, you know, they have savings, they have some resources, but I think you'll see more administrators looking at their budgets and seeing if they have to make cuts down the line.
Aaliyah Swaby covers public education in Texas for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Aaliyah, thanks again for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Monitoring social media, as he always does on this Tuesday, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Well, as I mentioned earlier, President Trump's return to the White House from Walter Reed Hospital, despite that positive coronavirus diagnosis and said to be shedding the infection onto others, definitely has folks talking. It was a real cable TV news spectacle yesterday, arriving at the White House, walking up the steps, and taking off his mask before walking into a crowd of people waiting for him inside the White House. Obviously, as folks talking. On our Facebook page, Dana Rowan says, "In my industry, we have a work philosophy of do it safely or not at all. Unfortunately, safety first is not a high priority for this president. Where's OSHA?" And Debbie Anderson says, referring to some of the president's words there, that we don't need to be afraid of the virus. We cannot let the virus dominate our lives. Debbie Anderson says, "If we don't need to be afraid of the virus, if we have the best medicines in the world, how come more than 210,000 Americans are dead?" And the president continuing to beat this drum, sort of downplaying the threat of coronavirus, tweeting earlier today, flu season is coming up. Many people every year, sometimes over 100,000, and despite the vaccine, die from the flu. Are we going to close down our country? No, goes on in that fashion. First, we should say that 100,000 figure seems to be largely inflated. But I should also state that this tweet and a similar message posted to Facebook, the Facebook message has been taken down in violation of the terms of service. The tweet remains, but there is a disclaimer that you have to click through to see it, saying that this tweet violated Twitter rules about spreading misleading and potentially harmful information related to COVID-19. So very interesting turn of events there, and I guess this preview of the messaging we're going to continue receiving from the president on this issue following his discharge from Walter Reed for the coronavirus, David.
I don't know if you've seen any messaging coming from Governor Greg Abbott's office of late, but he's been doing a little bit of tweeting, and some people at the some reporters at the Austin American-Statesman and the Texas Tribune picking up on it. It appears that Governor Abbott is poised to reopen Texas bars and lift some coronavirus restrictions, citing declines in COVID-19 hospitalizations and that sort of thing. Have you heard about that? We're opening soon.
That seems to be the chatter. Yeah, I believe it was yesterday he had that tweet, and, you know, as many tweets do, it had an animated GIF attached to it, and I believe it was cheers with the image of a couple beer steins clinking together. Right. So not incredibly subtle, but a sign there that appears to be in the offing relatively soon. Speaking of politics, just taking a quick look here at the headlines, I see the Lincoln Project planning to step up their Texas offensive against Republicans.
Well, a whole lot of news right now. We haven't even touched that much on the Attorney General's troubles right now, but the news continues, of course, 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. We urge you to visit us over there and get caught up on all that's happening in the Lone Star State. We're out of time for the broadcast, but we'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the crew, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.